Okay, well, good morning. I'd like to thank the organizers for the opportunity to spend some time talking with you today about computer algebra in computational finance. So, I'd like to give some examples of how computer algebra and just general computer mathematical systems find application within the area of computational finance, financial engineering, whatever you like. I'm from the Bank of Montreal, and in particular, I'm in a group called the Risk Management Group, Market Risk. Market Risk works closely with, for example, our trading floor. When you're trading instruments, you have got a set of potential rewards and a set of potential risks. And effective trading is about balancing off, being able to quantify the risks and the rewards. What we do is we provide systems, conceptual frameworks, and implementations of that risk measurement system. The group that I've got is directed very much towards modeling for market risk systems. We're worried about things like how much money could we lose over the next 24 hours under normal conditions? How much money could we lose under extreme conditions? What about over longer time horizons, 3 months, a year? What about from market movements or from counterparty defaults? And the challenge that we've got is to take those concepts and to try to put them into a language which will allow us to make some meaningful inferences that provide actual management guidance to help people as they manage the book. So, second slide. It's exactly what you've got in the web page. The only difference is the last line, which is my disclaimer. These are my opinions. They don't represent anybody else's, and in fact, they might not even be my own. So, let's get started. Computational finance is a relatively new field which takes concepts from numerous disciplines, mathematics, computer science, physics, applied mathematics, and combines them within the context of financial decision making. Financial decision making basically comes down to two things. As I mentioned, risk and reward, or think of it as fear and greed. And ultimately, the decision-making process comes down to weighing off the benefits and the costs of your actions. So what we do is we try to quantify that fear, we try to quantify that greed. What return are you getting per unit risk you're taking? The field's been around. Well, really, its modern form, you can trace it back to about 1973 when Black-Scholes and Merton first developed the now famous approach to pricing contingent claims, derivative securities. We'll be talking a bit about that. Although their work actually goes back to the early 1900s and the work of an economist named Bachelard, who developed essentially the very first description of Brownian motion to describe stock price movements, actually predating Einstein's description of Brownian motion by about 5 years or so. But in its modern form, it's been around for about 25 years, and it's really gone through several generations already. We'll talk about how each generation has spawned a particular set of problems, a particular set of tools to deal with those problems, and how computer algebra fits into those. And that growth is one of the trends in growing complexity. We work in an industrial setting. We work in a very business setting where we have to justify what we do against some bottom line. So we have to do that within the context of international competitive pressures, which push the complexity, push the types of problems that we're solving. I'm going to give you some examples of where we've used computer algebra systems. I've got three of them here. I learned a long time ago, you always give three examples. It's really simple. The first one is the one that you want to say anyhow. The second one lets you tell a nice little story that's peripherally related, and by the time you get to the end of that, you've thought of number three. So I want to talk about three examples here about how we're using computer algebra. They're not deep. They're not profound mathematically, but they are useful. We're going to talk about the use of computer algebra in a very traditional front office problem of calibrating a market risk model. We're going to talk about it in terms of a tool to provide very rapid response to an immediate business problem, i.e., how did our risk change post September 11th? And finally, I want to talk about this as a tool enabling us to get on with the business of creating a next generation of risk management systems. In a world that's characterized by increasing competitiveness, increasing complexity, what sorts of tools do we need in order to be able to do that work? And as we heard a little bit earlier in the first presentation, the view from the industrial side of the world is a little different from view from the academic side. This provides a little bit of context about the transition between those two worlds. You realize very early on that being a mathematician or a physicist or whatever it is, my background's physics, having a quantitative and analytical background sets you apart within an industrial or business setting. And we're the quants, or the geeks, or the nerds, or the propeller heads. Everybody on my team has got a little propeller beanie that is proudly displayed on top of their computers and is basically the symbol of membership of a small, elite, and completely misunderstood group. So, computational finance has been around for a couple of decades, and broadly speaking, it can classify the technologies and the problems within those decades. And here I've just indicated the sorts of products, derivative or option products, that you're likely to find in a trading book. And here, the way in which the risk profile associated with those products has changed. In the 1980s, it was really the beginning of the move towards derivatives. Derivatives are financial instruments that derive their value from some associated underlying. And essentially, they're a way of controlling risk. By taking a derivative position in something, you can choose either to lay off the risk that's associated with an investment, or you can choose to increase it. Why would you want to increase it? Because according to the basic CAPM principles, as you increase your risk, you should also be increasing your reward. Fear and greed again. So in the 1980s, a lot of the derivatives world was characterized by fairly vanilla products, ordinary products that are directly amenable to the type of analysis that was done by Black, Scholes, and Merton in the 70s. And to measure the risk on that, you were worried about sensitivity measures. So if I had a European exercise call, I've got one unit of a company's assets, one share of McDonald's or something like that, and I can have a call on it, which essentially expresses an opinion about the future value of that stock 3 months, 6 months, a year from now. If it's above threshold value called the strike, I can cash it in and realize a profit. If it's below that value, I'm out of the money. My option is worthless. And so a European exercise option has a definite endpoint. And you can make some general assumptions that we'll talk about in a minute about how you would value or how you would model the dynamics of that stock price and develop expressions for the value of the option. When I'm talking about the risk of that option, I'm worried about things called Greeks or the sensitivities. So I've got exposure to numerous sources of risk, the way in which the stock could move, the way in which the volatility of the stock could change, the way in which the interest rate that I'm discounting my cash flows at could change, and that sort of thing. And those are the things that we worry about. We're trying to come up with models that describe potential movements of those underlying risk factors. As time goes by, you start to get more complex. So you go from a relatively simple world, which is characterized by a high level of analytic tractability, you start to go into more complex products and more complex sorts of risks. So in the 1990s, broadly speaking, you had to move away from the traditional and classical, relatively simple products He started to look at things like securitization. You'd get a pool of mortgages, and then you would slice up that pool of mortgages and essentially sell cash flows based on that pool. Well, those cash flows are not driven solely by economic factors. They're also driven by customer behavior and consumer behavior. The way in which an individual chooses to refinance a mortgage is not necessarily consistent with the rational expectations hypothesis that a lot of economics is based on. So you now have to include consumer behavior into your model. Your risks just went up. You can also have more complex structures associated with the simple ones. You can take a very simple structure, like a European exercise call, and say, I'm no longer interested in a single discrete event 3 months from now. I want to be able to exercise over a continuous range of times when I want to do it. You've changed it from a so-called European to a so-called American. In the process, you've just made it path dependent. You could create an option on an average. Again, path dependency. You could link two or more options together to create baskets. And the payoffs that you get and the risks that you're exposed to increase accordingly. In order to measure those risks, we move away from simple sensitivity-based measures to something called value at risk, or VAR, which is what occupies a lot of my group's time. VAR is a statistical measure of how much money you can lose over the next 24 hours, say, to a 99% confidence level. And what we do is just take our portfolio, throw it into a big Monte Carlo generator, crank out 5, 10, 15, 20, 100,000 scenarios, whatever you need to do, look at the probability distribution and pick off 99th percentile. That gives you a sense of how much you could lose over the next 24 hours given the historical behavior of your risk factors and given your portfolio composition. It took about 5 seconds to describe. It's a little more complicated in practice. It's a tremendous challenge coordinating all of the data flows and getting the thing to work reliably. So that was really the risk landscape in the last decade. Over the next decade, there's going to be yet more complexity. More complexity because there's always a search for new underliers for your derivatives. Credit derivatives didn't exist in any real market sense 10 years ago. It's now a major market force. You can take derivatives on weather or on electricity or on any type of energy asset. You can start to hybridize your derivatives in order to create unique structured solutions to consumer problems. Suppose 10 years ago I may have owned a company, and 10 years ago I was interested in hedging out my interest rate risk. Well, now I might want to hedge out that risk but have a term profile. I want to hedge out my long-dated risk more than my short-dated risk, and I might want to link it to my equity returns so I can now link it with some stock market indicators. My product just got more complicated. My risk exposure just got more complicated. So the trend is towards increasing complexity. The trend on the modeling side is towards developing tools that will allow us to deal with that. I'm going to present a couple of examples right now. Example one actually goes back to the very first generation. It's sort of a problem that would have first come up in the 80s, early 90s. And this is a problem of calibration. Anytime you work with models, you go through a process called calibration. It's a process, but it's actually much more of a ritual, because the calibration process consists of going out into the market and collecting data that you think is representative of the way the market actually behaves. And you hope you're right, because it changes from day to day. It changes depending on the liquidity of the market, and it changes depending on the other participants in the market. A cap is an interest rate derivative, which basically, think of it as a call option on the spot rate. If my interest rate risk, if my interest rate goes above a certain level, the cap will have a non-zero payoff. If it's below that level, the cap has zero payoff. So what it's used for is a means of putting a ceiling on the interest rate that I will pay on a floating cash flow. And in fact, you can actually get things like this embedded into mortgage payments so that you will never pay more than X percent. Essentially, what you are doing is buying a cap. Caps typically are sold as a strip of quarterly exercise caplets. Each caplet is an individual option on that interest rate. Okay, so you've got a string of these things sold quarterly, but you can only get them in over-the-counter trading. You can only get those in annual bundles, 1 year, 5 year, 10 year, 20 year. And therein is the problem, which we'll get to in a second. The valuation of the cap is basically in a Black-Scholes world, you assume that the interest rates evolve log normally, i.e., you assume that the DR over R is normally distributed. Not a bad assumption, not perfect, but not bad, and it's a good place to start. Once you do that, you can crank the handle and create the stochastic differential equations that drive diffusion. From that, you can get PDEs, which are essentially a diffusion equation in two dimensions, and you can create analytic solutions in terms of simple functions, cumulative normal probability distributions. You've got a lot of analytic tractability. That much is easy. Now, you've got to manage the risks on that. I just said that your caplets come along in quarterly variety, but you only buy and trade these things on an annual basis. So you need some mechanism for taking annualized to quarterly volatilities. And if you're interested, that's the standard Black-Scholes approach. You've basically just got a cap that's specified by a bunch of times, rates, forward rates, and terms and conditions. You come up with solutions in terms of the cumulative normal probability distribution. And when you go out into the market or look on a Bloomberg page, that's what you see. You see that I can buy a one-year cap with an annualized volatility of 11.2%, and it's going to cost me 0.14 cents per dollar notional. And typically, I can get these things quoted out to about 20 years, 20-year maturity. That gives me a strip of 80 caplets. But I've only got about 10 observations. So I've got an inconsistency. I've got an underspecified set of equations. I need some additional business rules, additional constraints that I can put on my system in order to come up with a unique solution. And you can choose whatever you like. You can say, let's do that, creating the smoothest curve possible, creating the shortest curve possible, whatever. You can sit down with your traders and you figure out what the appropriate interpretation is. It's simply an optimization problem. That's what it comes down to. It's a nonlinear optimization problem. You can do that however you like. You can use a deterministic approach, a stochastic approach. You can throw the I Ching and see what happens. It's just another model. Well, we did this. And we originally did this in Maple a few years ago. And we started out doing this using a Lagrange multiplier approach and just set up the system of equations, let it run overnight and see what you get. And then you try and figure out how to get out of whatever local minimum you're stuck in. And over a while, went through several incarnations from Lagrange multipliers. We started looking at nonlinear least squares approaches, and then you started looking at stochastic optimization approaches, all within a computer algebra framework. And this developed into a robust and flexible prototype. But guess what? It's a prototype. Do you know how many years we've been using the prototype? I'm not going to tell you, but it's greater than one. But again, this comes back to I think what's one of the themes here. This is an industrial application. You're going to build something. You need to be prepared to live with it. Yes. Actually, we no longer have that. We've migrated that into its proper home. But the tendency is you build something, great, you finished that, move on. You've done one impossible thing, here's the next impossible thing you get to do. This is a very nice example because it was developed within a computer algebra framework. And it was actually put in and tested under extreme conditions. And came through quite nicely, provided a good learning environment for us. So, example one, lesson one, be prepared to live with what you do. Example two, interest rate risk. We talked a bit about interest rate derivatives, caps, floors, and that sort of thing a moment ago. Interest rate risk in general is the risk of loss resulting from unpredictable moves in short-term, long-term interest rates. How do you measure that? The term structure of interest rates tells you the present value of a dollar that you expect to receive at any determined time in the future, from 1 millisecond from now up to 30 years from now, or beyond. Essentially, there are an infinite number of points in that curve. You've got an infinite dimensional dynamical system you need to worry about. In reality, nobody bothers about that, and if you take a look at the way in which curves are represented, you pick about 100 points along the curve. A one-day point, a one-month point, and then they get further and further apart as you move out. But basically, you've got an infinite dimensional system you need to deal with. How do you go about condensing the information in that infinite dimensional system down to something useful? And one approach that's useful, easy to do, and fairly popular is principal component decomposition. It's entirely analogous. If you've got a physics background, it's analogous to a principal axis representation when you compute moments of inertia of a rigid body. And under a principal component approach, you construct a covariance matrix, diagonalize it using second-year linear algebra. The eigenvalues tell you something about the mean squared distribution in any particular direction. The eigenvectors tell you what your principal components or main directions of symmetry in the data are. And you can show that under fairly general conditions, the first principal component captures the bulk of the variance or the risk. Second captures the next biggest component that's orthogonal to the first, and so on. And so you truncate after 3, 4, 5, 7, whatever. And you're reasonably secure in the knowledge that you have captured the bulk of the risk using the minimum amount of data required. So you've truncated an infinite dimensional problem down to a much simpler, much more tractable, much more easily manipulated problem. Typically, when you do this, what you find is that the bulk of interest rate risk gets carried in parallel shifts of an interest rate curve. So Alan Greenspan decides that rates are going to go up by 50 basis points tomorrow. The entire curve goes up 50 basis points. That's your first approximation. The second approximation is to say, well, second principal component is telling you something about not the shift, but twist. So short rates may go up less than long rates. Third component tells you something about the bowing, and as you go on to higher components, you start to get more complicated modes within the curve. Why am I telling you this? Because this was really useful. A little over a year ago, one of the many challenges that we experienced as a result of September 11th was a massive disruption in markets. In no small part due to the fact that one of our providers, Cantor Fitzgerald, was on the 103rd, I believe, floor of the World Trade Towers. All of a sudden, there's no data available. And all of a sudden, nobody knows what's going on. And all of a sudden, all of the books, which have been nicely and carefully hedged and arranged, are doing something, but nobody's really sure what. So the challenge is, how do you deal with this? You've got a bunch of talented people, and you've got a problem that nobody could have imagined seeing coming. How do you measure the risks? We're supposed to be measuring risk. There's no data coming in. What do we do? Over the course of the first couple of days, we just went out. We started collecting data from wherever we could get it. And very quickly, threw together a PCA approach within a MATLAB MAPO environment. Very simple stuff. Nothing fancy. Get the data. Write 10 lines of code. Decompose the covariance matrix and take a look at how that's changing and how that's behaving. And then try and get a message out there if there is one. And what we did as a result of that was just very quick and dirty. I'll actually show you a couple of the results that we had. Completely meaningless unless you know what's going on. What we found was that over the couple of days that following September 11th, if you took a look at interest rate curves for the U.S., for Canada, for the pound, and for the euro, you did principal component decomposition using a weighted decay factor, never mind the values of the weights. But if you did that and took a look at it, what you found was that the curves, the interest rate world, was suddenly carrying its risk in a completely different way. This is the second principal component, if you're interested in this sort of thing. Pre-September 11th, you had a lot of diversity between different currencies. You had USD was moving in one particular direction, CAD was moving in another, and this is telling you something about the sensitivity in that second direction, which is tilting and twisting. And you had a fair bit of idiosyncratic variation between different currencies. Post-September 11th, a couple of things happened. Data's been disrupted everywhere. About a week later, the Fed made a surprise 50 beep rate cut. And that really took a lot of people by surprise. And the markets behaved as markets do. It's greed and fear. Greed's not ruling anymore. It's fear. One of the things that happens when fear takes over is you get a herd mentality. Everybody does the same thing. All of the correlations that you've spent ages preparing are thrown out the window. In a panic situation, what typically happens is everything moves together. Your correlation matrix now looks a lot like an identity matrix once, and everything's going down at the same time. And that's what you see here. Is look, pre-September 11th, you have a lot of diversity between the different markets. Post-September 11th, my second principal component is telling me that I've got a big risk associated with a shift, which is exactly what the Fed did. They dropped rates. So this end dropped down. It dropped down for four different currencies, all reacting the same way. So all of the hedging strategies that you've put together now have to be rethought, because what you thought was your risk up here has nothing to do with your risk down here anymore. We were able to do this analysis very quickly using some tools that were available because we had computer algebra systems. And as a result of that, you're able to go to the traders, and you're not actually telling them anything new. I mean, they can see the screens, they know what's going on too, but you are able to quantify it and say, hey, look, I know that the curve's tilting, I know that that's shifting, but here's the effect, here's the risk that you're carrying, here's the relative magnitude of what we're seeing. And this is how you need to change the way that your book is structured in order to avoid losses. So very quickly, a final example, prototyping. We build models. We build models to try to capture stochastic behavior, different risk factors. And we need tools in which to do that. The models are becoming more complicated. I've been talking about value at risk, where I'm trying to model the behavior of a few thousand risk factors over a short time horizon to a relatively low significance level. A couple of thousand risk factors, one day time horizon, and 99% confidence level. The world's changing. I'm no longer worried just about market risks. I'm now beginning to worry about credit risks, because each one of those risk factors is actually tied up to another company or another firm or another economic entity, which has got its own business plan, its own probability of survival or of default, and its own set of economic drivers that are directly related to my drivers. So I need to start worrying about how to measure credit risk and put that into my equation. Credit events are not like market events. A market event, I'm worried about a one-day loss, one day out of 100. Credit, I'm worried about a change in credit rating. I'm worried about a company or counterparty defaulting. Those are rare events. So I'm no longer worried about a 99% confidence level. I'm now talking about a 99.95. 1/20th of the tail from my market risk. So my simulation requirements just went up by an order of magnitude. Give you an idea of the complexity. Take a look at a bond, a government bond. So I go into the market and I buy a U.S. Treasury bond, 10-year bond, semi-annual cash flows, no credit risk because the standard is you're not expecting the United States government to default on its payments. So therefore, you treat that as the default-free rate. Now, how would I measure the risk on a corporate bond? A corporate bond, my corporate can default. So at any stage, essentially the shareholders in that corporation can say, hey, guess what? We're not going to pay off the debt holders right now. because we're going to do something else with it and declare legal bankruptcy. So essentially, from an options point of view, when I buy a bond from a company, I'm actually selling them an option. That option is an option to cancel cash flows on that bond at any time, dependent upon their own business strategy. So I've sold them an option. Not a simple one either. Multiple exercise opportunities, path-dependent. It's very complicated to model, even by today's standards in the market risk world. But that's a bond, the simplest thing you can get. When I start talking about the way in which I'm going to model an actual option, I've now got a compound option, an option on an option. I've got to model that, and I've got to model it using a much higher threshold than I had to for my market risk world. I need tools. I need tools that will let me do that. Let me build my simulation, build the blocks, and do prototyping. Why prototyping? Because this is expensive. We're talking about committing scarce resources of time, talent, money in order to come up with solutions. And you really want to know what the outcome is going to be before you start making those sorts of commitments. Here's some examples that I just put together from recent ways in which we've used computer algebra systems. Similar to what we've been talking about, but it's a sort of a nice variation, including some things that you just never see coming. Project management. What? Why would anyone do that? Because I've got a project that involves coordinating the activities of 100 people competing for the same scarce resources, trying to satisfy business demands, regulatory constraints, and God knows what else. And I've got to try and figure out the optimal commitment of resources to meet that. Well, it's real simple. I can write code and I can just let it run over the weekend and I can figure out which of my scenarios result in profit and which result in loss. And I hope I'm right. So anyhow, we've just had a very quick survey of some of the things that that we've been doing with the Bank of Montreal in applying computer algebra and just computer-assisted mathematics to decision-making, to modeling within computational finance. Thanks very much. A couple of minutes over. My apologies. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to do what I can. Thank you.